Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin on the phone from Boston.
Boston, Massachusetts.
That's correct. Home of John Kerry and Ted Kennedy.
And your beloved Red Sox. Right, Ken?
That's not funny.
All right. We're going to move right along to something else that's not funny. The most important vice presidential debate in all of recorded history. Ken, it was tonight. We just heard it, and it was, what was it, Ken?
It was, I don't know what it was, but I tell you, the anticipation of it was incredible. With a bunch of people, like several hundred people here in Boston for an association meeting, and it was like a heavyweight championship fight. People just couldn't wait for the bell to start. People were wondering how much material that Tina Fey would get. And I think, I would say, in my humble opinion, that both Sarah Palin and Joe Biden performed better than expected.
They defied expectations in a positive way because both of them seem to have been prepared and, if you will, rehearsed and, let's say, pre-programmed to a certain degree to do exactly the opposite of what people were tuning in to see them do.
Well, of course, everybody's tuning in to see a train wreck, and everybody wants to see a gaffe or a mistake or, you know, Gerald Ford freeing the people of Eastern Europe before it was entitled. They were entitled to be free.
They wanted to see the candidates embarrass themselves. They wanted to see.
And I don't think they did. I think what I did expect, I was wondering whether her 3 or 4 days in Sedona would program, you know, how a student tries to cram before a test in college. I thought that Sarah Palin might become victim to that, but I think she seemed relaxed. She smiled a lot. Unlike Joe Biden, she looked in the camera a lot, and I thought she acquitted herself fine. But Joe Biden, I expected almost like, you know, how he can be ingratiating, tell us how smart he is, wondering if whether he'd be condescending. But I think Joe Biden was also completely on the top of his game.
He was, in fact, as good as he was in his best debates back in 2007 when he was competing for the Democratic nomination for president and oftentimes getting kudos from people for having been the best presenter in those debates, even though he obviously wasn't getting very far with the voters. You know, I don't know if the test analogy, though, really worked out in this particular instance because this wasn't a test. Moderator Gwen Ifill from PBS did not take the same attitude at all that Charlie Gibson took on ABC or Katie Couric on CBS News of interrogating her, asking her what information she might have about the Supreme Court or foreign policy or what have you. It was quite different from that. It was really a performance opportunity for her, the likes of which we haven't seen since St. Paul, and she was ready for that. And let's listen to just a little bit of exchange from early on in the debate that established just how ready she was.
He did support deregulation almost across the board. That's why we got in so much
trouble. Would you like to have an opportunity to answer that before we move on?
I'm still on the tax thing because I want to correct you on that again. And I want to let you know what I did as a mayor and as a governor. And I may not answer the questions the way that either the moderator or you want to hear, but I'm going to talk straight to the American people and let them know my track record also.
So Joe Biden attacking John McCain, Gwen Ifill giving her a chance to respond. And then she responds with something that sounded very much as though she had been ready to do it, whatever the subject might have been.
Exactly. And I think, first of all, I felt from the beginning that Joe Biden's task was not to, was almost to ignore Sarah Palin and go after John McCain on behalf of Barack Obama. And I think he did that successfully. I think that Sarah Palin really decided to answer whatever the question was, she decided to answer the way she wanted, and she did that. But it was also interesting about Gwen Ifill, too, because, as you know, there was a lot of chatter on right-wing blogs that Gwen Ifill was in the tank for Barack Obama. She has a book coming out, scheduled to come out on Inauguration Day, that basically talks about great African-Americans in politics with a big headline about Barack Obama. And a lot of people on the right were saying that this was a fixed deal, a done deal in advance. And I think also Gwen Ifill went out of her way to make sure both candidates had chances to answer and answer sufficiently.
That's right. But even at the end of the debate, Sarah Palin was coming back to this issue and saying, wow, it was really great to have this chance to be here tonight and to speak to the American people without the filter. And for filter, of course, you can substitute the name Katie Couric or the name Charlie Gibson.
Or the name of liberal media elite.
That's right, in general. And, of course, Gwen Ifill might have played the role of harrying interrogator tonight, but she clearly had no plans to do that and was essentially there to let the two candidates be themselves.
And one thing you don't see on NPR, but it was clear, though, 100% of the time, Sarah Palin looked directly at the camera, directly at the American people, whereas most of the time, Joe Biden looked at Gwen Ifill when he was giving the answers, although towards the latter part of the debate, he was looking at the camera.
That's right. He split his time, but I think he was in a little bit of a bind. He didn't want to seem to be ignoring Gwen Ifill. In a way, Sarah Palin could get away with that, but Biden couldn't because he had to be respectful of both of the women he was on stage with.
That's a good point. And, you know, there is a strange dynamic, a very interesting dynamic when men debate women. We saw it with Barack Obama in January in New Hampshire when he talked about Hillary Clinton, you're likable enough. We saw this in 1984 when George Bush Sr. was the vice president at the time, was debating Geraldine Ferraro, and he gave her a lecture about, let me explain to you the difference between Iran and, you know, the outpost in Lebanon. And Geraldine Ferraro said, please don't, you know, you're patronizing me. And also when Rick Lazio in the 2000 Senate race in New York, when he encroached upon Hillary Clinton's space, a lot of criticism of him. So even though everybody said there was more attention on Sarah Palin, a lot of people wanted to know how Joe Biden would respond and how he would react again to the second time in history where a man debated a woman for vice president, and I think he certainly came out fine.
Yes, in fact, he came across as rather the soul of dignity, somebody with a warm smile and, you know, a certain amount of verve, but also kind of a dignified sort of statesman-like approach, which one does not usually associate with the highly voluble, loquacious Joe Biden.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, there was a lot of controversy, a lot of commentary after the last week's presidential debate where Barack Obama was often saying to John McCain that I agree with you, and he would look at him, whereas John McCain would not look at him at all. But every look I saw, at least on watching the TV, every time I saw Joe Biden, he would smile when it was appropriate. He would look concerned when it was appropriate. Nothing looked fake. And, of course, you know, Joe Biden, of course, choked up when he mentioned once again the 1972 death of his wife and daughter from a car crash. And, again, it just seems genuine. Joe Biden, again, he can be very infuriating at times. He could be obnoxious at times. But I think everything he said seemed genuine from the heart, at least from watching the debate.
Ken, let's dip into substance here just for a moment. I'd like to hear one other exchange on issues between these two candidates. Here they are talking about the Iraq war, how we got in, how we get out.
We will end this war.
Governor,
your plan is a white flag of surrender in Iraq, and that is not what our troops need to hear today, that's for sure, and it's not what our nation needs to be able to count on.
And yet, the Biden-Obama approach to Iraq, which has a timetable and which seems to contemplate holding the Iraqi government responsible for getting its own act in order and getting us out, seems to be prevailing in the polls. And certainly we have a clear majority of people who wish we had never gotten into Iraq in the first place.
Exactly. Just because the surge is working, and I think both sides, although the Republicans like to taunt Barack Obama saying that he's not acknowledged that it works, but even if we acknowledge the fact that the surge is working, that doesn't mean the war is popular or the decision to go into Iraq was popular. And I think that Biden's response to it was very correct and measured and popular. One thing that was interesting, though, when he kept saying over and over, well, he said it several times, that John McCain voted against funding the troops. But, of course, it was a measure that included a timetable, and, of course, John McCain would never vote for a timetable. I thought that was a little bit disingenuous, but for the most part, I thought Biden's arguments on Iraq and going to war was exactly what the American people needed to hear and wanted to hear.
And there were substantive discussions on energy. There were substantive discussions on taxes, on the bailout plan for the financial industry, on just a number of subjects. I think that a lot of people are going to be surprised when they realize the debate was 90 minutes long because it was entertaining enough and anticipation was great enough that it went by very quickly. Now, big question we have to ask, does a debate like this matter?
Well, you know something, we've said this over and over again. In the history of vice presidential debates, and of course they started in 1976 with Bob Dole and Walter Mondale, in the history, ultimately, and we say this over and over again, this is a question of who American people want to be president, Barack Obama or John McCain. I don't think the vice presidential debate changes that dynamic at all. Of course, a lot of people were very interested to see what would happen if Sarah Palin would implode, if Joe Biden would become Joe Biden. But ultimately, when all said and done, now that we see that Sarah Palin apparently has acquitted herself, it comes back to who do you want as the next leader, next president of the United States? And so ultimately that while there was a lot of interest, a lot of attention, and I suspect perhaps maybe even record audiences on Thursday
surely,
night.
Surely for a vice presidential debate,
exactly.
This will
and
be the record.
Of course, you remember last Friday's debate was apparently 10 million fewer watchers than Bush and Kerry in 2004. Of course, it was on a Friday night, and perhaps that was the reason. But ultimately, I think everybody got their say. Everybody got to see what the two candidates had to say. And now it's back to the focus, what it always was, on the presidential candidates.
I'm glad you brought up the first debate, Ken. That, too, was after our last podcast. And that first debate seems to have had an effect on the race, in tandem, of course, with the economic crisis the country's going through and some other effects that we can talk about. But it does seem to have contributed to a shift of momentum to the Obama campaign. And that, despite the fact that most commentators and observers and people who listen to these things for a living seem to think it was a pretty even split in that Friday debate, that both acquitted themselves well. Maybe Obama benefited from rather lower expectations for him in that debate, being less experienced on foreign policy and national security than John McCain.
Well, you could make the case that John McCain won the first debate because there was so much distraction around John McCain. He was talking about suspending his campaign and postponing the debate because of the bailout or the rescue program, whatever you want to call it, that he was running around the country, that he might be too frazzled, too angry, and yet I think he acquitted himself well. But having said that, first of all, one, Barack Obama showed that he was presidential. He appeared just as professional as John McCain on the stage. And two, if you go into the race and if you go into the debate, as we did last Friday, with Barack Obama having somewhat of a lead, and nothing in the debate changes that dynamic, then when Barack Obama comes out of the debate without his lead being challenged, then you can make the case that Barack Obama won. But, Ron, you and I talked right after that debate. I think we both feel that both did what they needed to do, and it was a pretty even-Steven debate. But, again, I guess people feel that if Barack Obama had the lead going in and had the lead coming out, then he must have won.
Clearly, there was something going on, because in the overnight polls that Friday night and Saturday morning, Barack Obama dominated by double digits. And in polls that were done throughout the weekend, the Gallup poll done on Monday, people were rating him specifically the winner of that debate. And there was a little effect on the overall number between the two candidates in all the polls last week and in some of the battleground states, which led to a real perception of momentum for the Obama campaign in the several days that followed. And it'll be interesting to see what happens after this debate. Now, I don't know how much stock to put in this, but just in the hour after the debate, a CBS News Knowledge Networks poll of uncommitted voters who watched the debate found 46% saying they thought Biden had won, and just 21% siding with Palin, the rest saying it was a draw or that neither did well. And a CNN poll, a similar poll, found that of their respondents, Biden was the winner according to 51%, and Palin the winner among 39%. Do we think we're missing something here, or are people perceiving something more uneven than you and I might have in this debate?
Well, I think it's not so much who won the debate, who outperformed, but who is ahead to begin with. I think if you support Obama and you thought he was ahead to begin with and nothing changed that, then you're still for Obama, and perhaps the Obama/Biden debater won. Whereas because the other CNN poll I saw was that I think 84% of those who watched Sarah Palin found that she did far better than anybody anticipated, and yet they still feel that Joe Biden won the debate. But, you know, again, it's very interesting how these things happen. I think that watching the debate as it's happening, and again, we go back to Obama and McCain last Friday night, I thought it was even, and as the days progressed, more and more people thought that Obama won. So I suspect that that's people who were for Obama to begin with rather than who decided who was the better debater on that evening.
That is possible as well. And let's put that in the context of some other things that have been happening. Before tonight, there were a number of negative stories about Sarah Palin and some of her unfortunate remarks in interviews with Katie Couric. And she had been obviously the target of a lot of jokes, late night comedians, Saturday Night Live, things of that that nature. And in addition to that, the general perception that John McCain's handling of the economic crisis last week, suspending his campaign or saying he was doing so, going to the White House, seeming to align himself with the House Republicans who subsequently blew up the bailout or rescue deal, all of that had not helped John McCain's perception, whereas Barack Obama's somewhat more aloof aspect around the whole crisis perhaps did. Bottom line, he started opening a lead in national polls, several battleground polls, and then today, rather stunningly, I thought, the McCain campaign let it be known, first locally and then acknowledging in a national conference call, that they were going to pull down their ads in the state of Michigan and cancel campaign appearances for John McCain in Michigan next week, essentially abandoning the state to the Democrats. What is going on there, Ken?
Well, what's fascinating about that is there's a bunch of states that George W. Bush won in 2004 that Barack Obama is clearly, if not leading, is clearly doing well in, states like New Mexico, Nevada, Iowa. Florida looks like it's dead even. Ohio is dead even. Clearly, John McCain needed to find a blue state that he would be competitive in. Michigan was one of his target states. Obviously, he didn't compete much in the primary there. Nobody seemed to, but he was hoping to make a difference with, you know, the famous Reagan Democrats in Macomb County. I think there was a fire
suburbs of Detroit
there not that long ago where they tried to bring back the specter of Reverend Wright as a possible ad, but it was not. It was not working, and I think the last polls I saw that had Obama up by about 6 points in Michigan, I think it was a pretty stunning acknowledgement by the McCain campaign that he was not going to win that state, and he had to put more emphasis and more money and more troops in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania. If he loses Ohio, then it's hard to see how McCain wins. I think given the fact that he does have some limitations about money, pulling out of Michigan made sense.
I suppose so, although putting the money into, say, Pennsylvania, for example, at least on the numbers, would not seem to make much more sense. Pennsylvania has 21 electoral votes, Michigan just 17. But the numbers in Pennsylvania in this week, in this same week, when Michigan started to go south on McCain, are really not any better, not much more encouraging. Perhaps it's just a bigger prize if he could pry it away. He's also, McCain, trying to go into Wisconsin and Minnesota, two other states that have been blue, going all the way back to the 1988 election, and trying to pry those away from the Democrats.
And, of course, Minnesota goes back to 1972, voting for Nixon as the last time they voted for a Republican. Minnesota has gone longer without voting for a Republican for president than any other state in the country.
And yet the numbers there have, up until this last few days, been rather encouraging for the Republicans.
But again, I think with the economic crisis, with the uncertainty about Wall Street and what's going on there, it's interesting how not only has Barack Obama pulled ahead in the national polls, and every poll shows him ahead, whether it's 2, 3 points or 8 points,
yes,
I've seen.
Yes, but even the battleground poll, which previously had always had McCain ahead.
But even on issues like national security, it's very interesting. When John McCain pulled ahead with his Sarah Palin pick, a lot of people liked him better on the economy, which was very interesting. And now that Barack Obama's pulled ahead, polls show that they like Barack Obama better on national security and defense, which has long been John McCain's strong suit.
You know, it's funny. If you ask people first who they're for and then you tick off the issues, they do tend to tell you who they're for and then go with that person on the issues. If you start with the issues question and ask whom they are for last, oftentimes you will find more discrepancy between how they feel about issues and which candidate they're for.
That's absolutely true. Now, we did see a kind of a good news for McCain 2-3 weeks ago that is completely dissipated. But the question is, we're doing this podcast
in the wee hours of Friday morning before the House is scheduled to vote later this morning on the rescue plan package.
32 days before November 4th. It'd be interesting to see if there'd be another October surprise. But right now, John McCain is going to have some kind of a change in dynamic if he's going to come back and win this thing.
He's got some opportunities. If this bailout or rescue plan puts the economic question not behind us, but just a little bit less front and center for a few days, and if there should be something that arises on the foreign policy scene, or if he can break through in that October 7th town hall debate in Nashville, or on the last debate, October 15th, then John McCain can still turn this momentum around.
Right, but again, in the two debates so far, we've seen nothing in either debate that seems to have changed the general appearance of what's going on.
Quickly, let's talk about a couple of Senate races that we haven't been talking about too much. We noted last week that Liddy Dole seems to be in some trouble down in North Carolina.
Against a nondescript candidate, but Elizabeth Dole has not been around. She has not campaigned. And the last polls I saw showed Kay Hagan, who I always thought was an unimpressive candidate, the Democrat leading by 4, 5, 6 points. And that would be an amazing shocker, given the fact that Elizabeth Dole was thought to be sleepwalking to a second term.
That's right. And now out in Oregon, where Gordon Smith, the incumbent Republican, had at one time thought to be vulnerable in particular on the Iraq War, seemed to then shore up over the spring and summer and reassure people that he was not a George Bush type of guy. He was going to be an independent kind of senator and seemed to be kind of in control. The Democrats nominated Jeff Merkley, maybe not their strongest statewide candidate, and it looked like Smith was going to be fine. Now the numbers, perhaps influenced by the national climate, the Obama campaign, show Merkley back in the run.
Exactly, and there's also a third-party candidate there, a conservative, who seems to be pulling away votes from Gordon Smith. It was interesting a few months ago, a few weeks ago, Gordon Smith was running ads saying, I agree with Barack Obama a lot. Obviously, he tried to disassociate himself from President Bush, but a lot of people thought that would help him. But again, if there is a Democratic trend, if there's a move towards Obama, it could be reflected in the Senate races too. And Gordon Smith, who I think we both agreed that was heading to a re-election just a couple of weeks ago, now is in for the fight of his life.
One more. This is really a reach. This is one I really can't wrap my mind around. But just to put it out there, we're down to single digits between Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, thought to be absolutely impregnable this year, and a self-financing Democratic candidate named Bruce Lunsford.
Well,
Bruce Lunsford. Ken, that's Bruce Lunsford. You do know Bruce Lunsford, correct?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, he ran for governor in 2003 and 2007, and the primaries lost in both times. I still think that McConnell wins, but if you are angry at Republicans, if you are angry at the way the Republicans are conducting business in Congress, even though they're the minority, they're still the party of George W. Bush, who would pay for it other than Mitch McConnell, who's the minority leader in the Senate? If he goes down, and again, he's one of the canniest Republicans I could think of, very strong.
Oh, in Kentucky, you're not going to see a big wave for Obama under any circumstances.
No, but we did see, you know, the Democrats recapture the governorship last year, and there seems to be an anti-Republican trend. If Mitch McConnell goes down, then obviously it's far worse of a Republican year than most people think. What's interesting about election night, and we always talk about this on November 4th, early states like Kentucky and Indiana, those are the two early states, if we see...
Their polls close earlier than other people.
Polls like, I think, 6:30 Eastern time.
So they report earlier than anyone else.
If Mitch McConnell goes down early, I just remember 1980 when Birch Bayh of Indiana
That's
went
right.
down early in 1980.
Katie, bar the door. If something happens to Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, it is definitely going to be a big night for the Democrats.
Absolutely.
Here's one other point to make about that. Given that he does have a real race on his hands, you had to take your hat off to Mitch McConnell for what he did this past week in the Senate. He and Harry Reid, who is not on the ballot this fall, stood up together and said, we're going to rescue this rescue package. We're going to do what they couldn't do in the House. We're going to lead. We're going to lead on a bipartisan basis. We're going to deliver big majorities of both parties behind the president's plan. Of course, nobody thinks it's great. Of course, we know that as a populist issue, it's a huge loser, but we're going to get it through because we think that's what the country needs. Mitch McConnell was a stand-up guy this week, whether you like the package or not.
Sometimes profiles and courage is a nice thing to talk about. Yes, talk radio is very important. Yes, your re-election in November, in less than in 30 days or so, is very important too. But sometimes profiles and courage has to come out. And, you know, it's interesting. Maybe on Monday it was a bailout package, but I think when the House votes on Friday, it's more of a rescue package. And I think the dialogue has changed, the mood has changed.
The marketing has changed.
Absolutely. When we saw the House vote go down, we also saw the stock market go down as well. And I think members of Congress from both parties realized what happened on Monday that will most likely not be repeated on Friday. But again, how many of us could have predicted what happened on Monday?
And Ken, as much fun as this has been, I've got to say, that's it for this week's political podcast.
But also, can I say that you can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/elections.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
You say either, and I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato, and I like patata. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.